Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. I want to again thank Davida and thank Eileen Hubin and Marina Kroll and everybody and Anne and everybody who's done all the work to help put together this wonderful Shabbos that we just had. And we're very excited to have Rabbi Clapper himself this morning to speak about halakh morality and mental disability. Without further ado, Rabbi Clapper.
Good morning. Always wonderful to be here. This is a group of people that I always love sharing Torah with. And I will ask your indulgence this morning because today, as opposed to giving a fully finished product, I'm going to try and think out loud with you. And hopefully we'll come out with something that works together. I want to say that it's absolutely, first of all, I want to express my gratitude to Rabbi Strauss and everyone else who was involved in setting up the whole program for this year. It is a source of great joy to have alumni of the Sanhedrin Midrash serving as rabbis in local shuls, both in Kadima and Young Israel of Sharon. I think that's a very wonderful sign for the Boston community. And I look forward to building and deepening our relationship and creating more and more programming in the area as we move forward. I think that it's worthwhile to say at the outset that I am the first generation of which you can say Vayakumu Talmidim Chadashim Asher Liyadu Et Yosef. The first generation of modern Orthodox students who did not have personal experience of Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Not for lack of trying in a certain sense, although I didn't take advantage of the public opportunities when I was younger. As soon as I knew I was going to Yeshiva College, I did my best to negotiate my way into the Rav's Shir, because I knew it was likely to end soon. As a freshman, when I finished in Makorot early, in Rabbi Willig's shir, I would go into the Beit Midrash and review the Rav's shir with a chavrusa from his shir, and then I tried very hard to get into his shir as a sophomore. Didn't work out. One of these things where where God prepares the next generation, because the year the Rav stopped giving shir, which was my sophomore year, Rabbi Rosenzweig started, and I had the privilege of being in Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig's first shir. So I'm the first generation that didn't actually hear the Rav directly. But despite that, I would say that I grew up in a modern Orthodox intellectual universe that was utterly shaped by the Rav's thought. I think Rav Lichtenstein, as a Zichrono Livracha, would have said that the Rav bestrode modern Orthodoxy like a colossus, and it was really impossible to think about any kind of theological issue without relationship to the Rav's thought. And I have really thought about religion for all my adult life, in alternate waves of thinking that I really got the Rav this time, and in radical disagreement, but never out of dialogue. The illustration I like to give about this is when I first came to Maimonides School, which is something like 23 years ago, and I had a first senior class, and I spent the senior class explaining to them often how it was that my theology differed in various details from Rabbi Soloveitchik. It took until April for a student to be willing to admit to me that no one had ever taught them anything about Rav Soloveitchik, and they had the faintest idea what I was talking about. It was an important pedagogic lesson that not everybody lives in the same intellectual universe or sociological universe that I do. So the works that had the most impact on me, like many of us, one was the English translation of a 1940s essay called Isha Halakha, which was published as Halachic Man, and that was sort of the dominant work. It had a precursor called Halachic Mind, which was actually written in the 20s, I believe, and is very related to the Rav's doctoral thesis back in Berlin, but wasn't published until much later. What I want to set out are the framework of thought that, at least when I was in yeshiva, people set out as this is what the Rav thinks, and that I think really created the framework that I was thinking in and rebelling against. I want to talk about some of the difficulties I had with that, talk about how a new posthumous work has perhaps validated some of the ways in which I wrestled with that earlier, and then that'll be part one of the shir, and then in part two, I want to bring you in, it'll be a great review for the fellows, I hope, to some of the moves that we've tried this summer dealing with the issue of mental disability, And then hopefully some of the connections will be evident to you, or some of the ways in which they're working together. And if not, then you can all afterwards imagine how the two parts of the Shir are connected, connected to each other, and think creatively. So if you turn to the opening page of the Makorot, this is from... everyone have copies? Yeah, okay. This is from Halachic Mind. It's the yellow book. here is a quote from page 91 to 92. He says, "One of the most perplexing problems that has confused the finest of minds is that of the rationalization of the commandments Tamei HaMitzvot." And here he makes a strong claim. Maimonides' attempt at rationalization, more so than any other of his theoretical undertakings, brought forth a historical controversy. Judging Maimonides' undertaking retrospectively, one must admit that the master whose thought shaped Jewish ideology for centuries to come did not succeed in making his interpretation of the commandments prevalent in our, sorry for the typo, world perspective. That's a very strong claim. One of the really interesting things about Halachic Mind, which is the way in which the Rav really disagrees with the Rambam in very strong ways. And he says the Rambam's conception of Ta'amei HaMitzvot, which many of you know is built on the association that the Torah's commandments relate to the specific historical circumstances of the Jewish people in the desert, simply did not work. And although everyone loves the Rambam, that really is not the way in which Jews have conceived of mitzvot. And he frames this not as a result of the specific issue of historical reasoning, but he thinks in general that Jewish theology is and should be resistant to the idea that mitzvot can be explained on the basis of some prior idea. Right, he says that Maimonides' failure to impress his rationalistic attitude upon the vivid religious consciousness is to be attributed mainly to the fact that the central theme of the Maimonides exposition is the causalistic problem. Instead of describing the outcome, Maimonides explains why it happened. Along the lines of, well, this is not the specific reason Maimonides gives, people explaining that the reason the Torah bans pig is because pigs have trichinosis, or give you trichinosis. Right? So that notion, that mitzvot have a reason, the Rav opposed strongly. And he built... Right, and he said that the way to do Jewish theology is not to explain where halacha came from, but to start from halacha and develop halacha without any relationship to any prior ideas. And then the most you can do is to say that halacha has this consequence, as opposed to this is why halacha happened. Right, so you could say that not eating pig prevents you from having trichinosis. But that's very different than saying the Torah bans pig because it prevents you from having trichinosis. That was one of the Rav's strong claims. And framed philosophically, what it meant was that the discipline of halacha had to be autonomous. It had to be developed independently of any other kind of consideration. Halacha comes first, and then everything else comes out of halacha, as opposed to being there to explain halacha. Now, that has implications in other areas as well. Because it's all very well and good to talk about it in terms of historical Tamei HaMitzvot. That, I think, it's very easy to say, okay, right, you know, limiting halacha to specific past historical circumstances obviously has difficulties. What happens if those circumstances change? Right? What happens if pigs no longer carry trichinosis, or we have antibiotics, or whatever the issue may be? But the philosophic claim that halacha has to be autonomous also means that you can't have any intrusion of notions like morality. Because explaining that this is the halacha is this way because it's good to be nice to people is not any different in the Rav's theology than explaining the halacha is this way because it's better to be healthy than sick. Yes, you do.
But that's not really a fair thing to say that the problem is that it suffers the ability to be undone, because half of the explanation is about ancient idolatrous practices that don't exist anymore. Rambam clearly was not bothered by the idea of this.
That's true. The Rambam wasn't bothered by it, but many of us are.
He wasn't bothered by it. Underlying presumption of his way of explaining mitzvah is that we're talking about the source of mitzvah. We're not talking about the current reason that we do the mitzvah.
So you can respond and try and make a similar distinction. Pardon?
So let's talk about, I think, we said genetic attitude. Talk about part of the Rambam translation is the source of mitzvah and where they come
That's
from
right.
more than why they currently apply.
So the Rav thinks that you're right, that the Rambam might very well say that a mitzvah has an initial cause, and then it has there's a different cause for its continuation. Right? But the Rav would be very unhappy with the notion of cause at all. Right? He opposes the notion of cause at all. But I don't want to get into whether the Rav's critique of the Rambam is right, because I'm interested in the Rav, not the Rambam. All right? That's his critique of the Rambam. In very harsh terms on occasion. Okay, so that's stage one, is that the Rav appears to argue that halakha has to be an entirely autonomous endeavor, and I always had grave difficulty about the notion that the halakha should not be influenced by considerations such as morality and ethics. It seems, right, and this is not an original critique, it's a fair way of framing it within the yeshiva world, is that it's to some extent the Telzer critique. But I wanted to frame that as number one. Okay, number two, and here I took a single example from the English and Hebrew books. The red and blue books, right? They're the Halachic Man and Isha Halacha. I think Isha Halacha comes in multiple covers now.
I have a brown one.
You have a brown one, yeah. That might just be because you lost the dust jacket. But all these books were designed to look alike, so that's the...
Can I ask one question?
Yes, Jack.
So, it seems to me that you have to, when you look at the Rav's statement against the Rambam, you have to look at the times in which he's saying it, okay? And you have to look at what happened in the Reformation, especially for Jews, with Reform Judaism and their attitude towards mitzvot. And in a way, the Rav is fighting that fight and saying, no, because if you were to ask, I don't know about all, but if you were to ask many Reform Jews why the prohibition for eating pig, and I'm surprised you use that example, is operative, and they would say it's not operative because it was created for a health reason. The health region no longer exists, therefore we don't have to do that mitzvah. We don't have to follow that mitzvah anymore. So I think you really have to look at the overall picture of what the Rav was fighting, what he was fighting for and against in that dynamic of critiquing the Rambam.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's absolutely right. There are a whole variety of philosophic movements both within and without Judaism that if we wanted to give historical causation explanations for the Rav, which he might very much have resisted on the same grounds.
No,
we could say that he's opposing reform. That's very clear in sections of Halachic Mind, that he is emerging from a particular school of Neo-Kantianism, which we won't have time to talk about much today, and that in some ways he is in a very interesting relationship with Romanticism. Coming out of Germany at that period, I think those are all true. But I'm taking him in his own framework. Like these are ideas he had, and we could talk about whether those ideas are more or less powerful nowadays than they were then. But right now, I'm just trying to take the ideas as such.
Okay.
So in Halachic Man, there are a number of famous scenes along these lines. There are also a number of famously contradictory scenes, but we're going to take this one, and we can talk about the contradictions, perhaps, as people raise them. So in Halachic Man, he says the following. When a Halachic Man comes across a spring bubbling quietly, he already possesses a fixed a priori relationship with this real phenomenon, the complex of laws regarding the Halachic construct of the spring. The spring is fit for the immersion of a Zav. It may serve as Mechatat, the waters of the Paraduma that deal with impurity contracted from dead bodies. It purifies with flowing water. It doesn't have to be still water. It does not require a fixed quantity of 40 sa'az as the amount of water that you need in a mikveh, in a still mikveh. Halakhic Man is not overly curious, and he is not particularly concerned with cognizing the spring as it is in itself. Rather, he desires to coordinate the a priori concept with the a posteriori phenomenon. So if we just leave the Latin out for a moment... What he says is, you have an idea, you have halachic ideas, and when you look at the real world, your sole interest is in trying to figure out how does this real world fit into my prior halachic concepts. And he gives you a number of analogies for this. It's as if your life is focused on geometry, so you're looking around this room and you're just categorizing and you're saying, like, okay, well, this room is an irregular polygon. It has right angles, you know, in certain places. We could try and look for triangles and things like that. There are characters. I think it's, you know, sort of a motif on certain kinds of television shows when you have characters who have sort of robotic qualities. I think it's in Sherlock as well, right? You know, where you look at what would be in human would be color vision. Everything is reduced just to lines, right? To lines and numbers and things like that. So halachic man has that kind of reductiveness. He looks at a spring, and he thinks mikveh, and only the things that are relevant to the mikvehness of the spring will relate to him. So he's not interested, for example, in the rate. In the rate of the bubbling of the spring, because that doesn't matter halachically, you just have the one category flowing or not flowing. He's not interested in the way in which the light reflects off the spring, or any issue like that. And that that spread to a much broader attitude, which I was always resistant to, which is the idea that halachic man is really the only legitimate mode of religious experience. That things only have meaning insofar as they are constructed by halacha. There's a story that is told about the Rav, which I think correctly upsets lots of people. So I'm going to tell the story, but being word advanced that it upsets lots of people. It upset my wife when I said it yesterday. So you can disbelieve the story if you wish. So I'm going to tell the story not as a story about the Rav, but as a story about the way in which the Rav is taken culturally, right? And so, because this is a story that you tell about the Rav, and that's valuable. That's valuable culturally. The story involves a woman who comes and asks the Rav if she's allowed to put on a talit with tzitzit, despite the Ramah. And the Rav tells her to go put on a talit without tzitzit for a month and find out if that's a powerful religious experience. And if it turns right, and the implication is that if it is a powerful religious experience, she'll come back to him. And he'll tell her, oh, that's fine. So she comes back after a month, and the Rav asks, how was it? And she says, it was an amazingly powerful religious experience. And he says, so obviously, the mitzvah has no meaning for you at all, because there's no mitzvah to put on a talit without tzitzit, so there's no purpose in your putting the tzitzit on anyway, because your whole religious experience is invalid. Because you're having, right, you're interested in the subjective, right, in a subjectively created phenomenon, as opposed to the objective experience of mitzvah. Okay, my wife has all sorts of critiques of the story. Like, there is a religious meaning to putting on something from which you're putter, as opposed to, right, so whatever. I'm not going to go there. The underlying theme, which I think had still has strong cultural power, is the idea that at least Jewish religious experience only has validity in the categories of halacha, and there's no space for religious experience that is totally subjective and built on your direct reaction. Yes, Daniel?
Where does the Rav say that? The Rav is just describing this character, this archetype.
So I have argued, as you know, that the right that Ish Halacha is not intended to be the total religious experience.
And if he then conforms to what you see the Rav do, and it is suck, and the way he addresses
female issues. I'm not... I think, confident, talking about the way the Rav paskened. I think that there's still lots of people who know a lot more about that living in Boston, and most of them, for some reason, feel compelled not to write down what they say and feel like that's an oral tradition that should not be shared. I was just talking to a local Rav recently. He was telling me how many shilas he asked the Rav. Rabbi Helfinger, Alav HaShalom, never gave me access to what he said were the written files of the Rav Pesachim in the KVH. I don't know if they still exist. So I don't know. I tend to agree, right? I'd make a much stronger critique, which is that which is based on Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, I think, framed very sharply, that halachic man would never write the book. Probably halachic man would never read the book. He's not overly curious, and so the Rav wrote the book. So obviously he's not halachic man. There is space, right? There is space for a much broader. Nonetheless, much of the Rav's writing seems to come through that kind of prism. We can say that he spent much of his life expounding the perspective of a halachic man. And so it would be nice if, at some point, the Rav said, explicitly, as opposed to the kind of implicit arguments that we make, or historical arguments we make, or personal arguments we make. That's not the case. But I at least had not found anything explicit of that sort until the emergence of this posthumous book, which we can call, I don't know, the off-white book, the beige book. Yeah, same color, cream, thank you. Crew, I don't know. The halachic morality. So I have a very ambivalent relationship towards the vast number of posthumous books that have come out about the Rav, as opposed to the very limited things that were published in his lifetime. For one thing, it's just a lot of stuff to read to know the Rav, and I learned the other stuff when you're young, and you like to emphasize the Girsa Yankusa, the things that you learn when you're young always have more power than the things you learn when you're old. The Rav's son, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, has in his eulogy for his teacher, his father, all copies of which I believe have mysteriously disappeared. But he gave a beautiful description of why, in which he claimed that the Rav's shiurim were all based on the Rishonim that he read before he was 30. And that other Rishonim he acquired later in life, and you'll never see the Rav's shiur based on, even though he knew them all, and he would quote them, but he never based a shiur on something that he read, on something that he learned after he was 30. So, by the same token, I read these books before I was 30, and my vision of the Rav is based on them. But I have other than self-interest, I have, I think, a deeper reason, which is I think that people legitimately can choose which things enter the canon, the things that they stand behind, and which things they said tentatively, experimentally, and are not really what they want to be the conception of their thought. And in particular, what I want to suggest is that the Rav was a systematic thinker. He liked to believe he was constructing something like a theory of everything. And if you have that, so what you'll often do is you'll try to say, look, here's an area of life or religion I have not yet explained. Let me make the effort. It could be a long effort. It could be teaching a whole course in a graduate school, which is what much of that book is. And at the end of teaching that, you could look up and say, wow, that didn't work. It doesn't fit, or I don't know how it fits yet, and I'm not sure enough that it's true, that I'm going to publish it as part of my system. And there, you know, I could be projecting, but I know that one of the powerful and important experiences I have sometimes is, you know, I give a shiur that I'm really committed to, and one of my students comes up to me and says, Rabbi, doesn't that completely contradict this big system you set up 2 years, you know, 3 years ago in a shiur I heard from you? And the answer is, well, I didn't realize that. You're right, and so I can't really give that shiur the same way anymore. I gave it, I can't deny I gave it, but it's not going to get published, because it doesn't fit. Or sometimes I'll explicitly set out to accomplish something. Sometimes that's, you know, the whole effort of the Summer of Beit Midrash is an attempt to accomplish something, and at the end of the day, I think it failed. So I gave those shiurim, but in the end, they didn't work. So I'm very leery about claiming that there's a purpose in trying to integrate, per se, things that appear in the posthumous works into the overall theology of Rabbi Soloveitchik. But what they can show is that, I think at the very least, is that he was bothered by certain issues. He saw certain kinds of gaps. So in this work, Halachic Morality, there is the title essay, which is this fascinating thing, at least as the editors tell us. It's an undated manuscript, which we have no trace of anywhere. It's not no one remembers him giving it as a shiur. There's no context at all. It's just something he wrote. It's a standalone piece and just never got out. So we don't know why it never got out. We have no reflection of it anywhere else. And here's what I think is a very central thesis in it. He says halachic law, which is what all of halachic man is about, which is where halachic man's consciousness is focused on, and in which, you know, if we trust the story, that's really all there is to. What all of Jewish religion has to come through that, is a product of the divine logos ethos activity. The latter resulted in the emergence of a theoretical normative system in a body of ideas / nomoi, and that's lots of fancy foreign language terms which mean it resulted in halakha as an intellectual system. But then he says something that's really quite astonishing. Halachic morality, on the other hand, was born from the great God experience. Whoever has seen the real and perfect is determined to be real and perfect too, since in his eyes, imitating is the only way in which he can commune with the real and the perfect. This is my God, and I will be like him, just as he is, so I shall be. And he sets this up in the context of a theory of revelation at Sinai, that there are two elements of the revelation at Sinai. One is just the experience, the mysterium tremendum, he would say, somewhere else, of God's revelation, and the other is the actual content of the Ten Commandments and of Torah. Two completely different spheres of religious experience, grounded in different experiences of God, and so therefore we must say that morality, in contradistinction to the halachic law, is a personal, subjective affair. As opposed to all this rhetoric about halacha being objective, there's a wholly different sphere of religion, called halachic morality. If you turn the page, you'll see it says, first, morality does not lend itself to objectification in the form of precise definition and formulation. It is impossible to describe morality in distinct cognitive categories. We have to use metaphors, allusions, indirect media, because we deal not with concepts or structures, not with laws, but commitments stemming from our religious perceptions and intuitions. And the second way is that moral commitments cannot claim uniform universal validity, equally binding on all times without taking into account the incompatibility of individual tempers and modes of thinking. That is why there is no psach halacha, no authoritative halachic ruling in matters of morality. So that's really just astonishing, if you've read everything else the Rav wrote. You know, there is a whole sphere of Jewish religious activity which is definitionally subjective, which is not filtered through halacha, but is in contradistinction to halacha, which is not subject to rules, but has to be judged by situations, and which is not which has to be different for all people. Okay, so I think that this validates, at least raising the kinds of questions I asked. One is obviously, where is the space? You know, what is the space in Jewish religion that is outside the formal structures of halacha? And then really the second question is, so the Rav, and this I think is really a family thing, never, and this is the only answer we have, so you have no real way of knowing what he would do. I have hints, but all I know he would do. Are these really completely distinct spheres? What happens when the two come into conflict? Right? What happens when you have a choice as to whether to respond to something out of the realm of the objective halakha or out of the realm of the God experience in Imitatio Dei? So here we have a validation of the whole challenge of, because it's very hard to imagine that real life halakha is applied as such without any relationship to the notions of halachic morality. Yes, Anna?
How distinct can he possibly be portraying them when he describes... He doesn't talk about morality, he talks about halachic morality.
So he does.
And halacha means law. Or at least usage.
That's a great question, and that would seem to me to mean that he does believe there has to be some kind of interpenetration. Here's what I would like it to be. But again, I'm trying to integrate it into a system that where he never does, and I'm not sure how fair it is to integrate it anyway. What I would like it to be is that there's a halakha which is determined as an abstraction, and there's morality, and then there's a halakha as carried out in practice. And the halakha as carried out in practice is the result of the intersection of these two.
As in, like, the difference between personal psak and, say, an overview of...
Lots of ways in which we can frame it. It's too shallow because there are going to be spaces where there's no halakha at all, and he insists on that. But I would like to be able to say that, but that would be taking the standalone essay and saying, okay, I have this whole structure. If I fit it in, this is what would happen, and I want to say again. It might be that the Rav thought of that, and that's why the essay was never published. All right, precisely because he saw it lend itself to that argument. Yes?
This goes nicely with you were talking about the great Boston secrecy about not giving any written access to at least Psak. I know Rabbi Helfinger told us and a friend of ours who got reprimanded for sharing out of school directly that his philosophy, and alluded that it was the Rav's philosophy, was that a Psak Halakha was a personal matter. And there were certain Gadolei Hador who had to write them down for various reasons, write certain ones down. but that ultimately a sock was to the person who asked the question, and therefore to write it down, spread it around, even to say Rabbi so-and-so ruled thus and such in my case, was a violation of that relationship and would cause people to not properly ask halakhic questions because they think they could open up a book and say, this great rabbi said this is the answer.
So that's really interesting. Thank you. So far as I know, the Rav has no... There's some things in letters published by Natty Helfgott in some years ago, I think, called Community Confidence and Commitment. So there's some places in those letters where he talks about a philosophy of psak halakha, but really very little. So you might be right that there's a reflexivity there that he thought it was inappropriate to talk about that in that way. Very good. Yes, Dana. Yes, and like everything else with the Rav, there's lots of controversy about everything that some students wrote and other students write. Maybe he told different students different things, but on principle, so very hard for me to build off things that students wrote, just because later in his life, my tradition is that you could bully him into agreeing with you. And so students often came out thinking he agreed because he simply couldn't resist for long periods of time. So I'm nervous about that. Yes?
He goes from saying that morality doesn't lend itself to justification to saying it's impossible to describe morality in some cognitive categories. How does he make that leap? He just sort of dismisses the whole pursuit of objective moral systems and philosophy.
So that's a great question, right? That's an absolutely great question, and I'd just be speculating because he doesn't relate to any of these big questions. He doesn't relate, what do we do with Kant, right? He's a Kantian, right? What do we do with the categorical imperative? What do we do with any of that? He doesn't, the whole notion that morality is supposed to be rule based. It's part of why this is just an utterly astonishing essay. And there's a possibility, and this is where my utter lack of bacute in early 20th century philosophy shows up. Some of the Rav's books seem to be very clearly that he read somebody else and thought that somebody else is really powerful. What would happen if you mapped that somebody else onto Judaism? And so it could be that I just don't know the philosopher that this is based on.
And it feels like there's a whole book missing between those two sentences.
I think that's right.
It's just notes.
That's the one you burned.
I think that's right.
I can't publish it because I had to...
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. It is really quite astonishing for a Kantian to make claims like this. But I'm not an old expert. Absolutely right. Yes, Chuck, you want to ask anything?
I just wanted to make the statement that I think that is a general that what was stated before about Pesach is a generally accepted practice with most great poskim that they would prefer not to make it public because your question is really not the same as my question. You have to phrase the question in a certain way. Different people get different answers because of the level of where they are. So somebody who is very knowledgeable might get a totally different answer than somebody who's new to Judaism. And that's why you can't do that. And that's why these are all very private. There are many times that I would go to ask my Rebbe a question, who is, of course, Rabbi Tversky himself, who is a student of the Rav in many ways. And every time I asked a question, he would tell me, I'm answering this for you. Okay? And that tells me that it's not for, it might be you and your family, but it's not for everyone. So I just want to reinforce that.
I think that's right. What you're saying, essentially, right, is that the Rav sets up one realm which is wholly objective and he calls it halakha, and one realm which is wholly subjective and he calls it morality. The psak halakha comes somewhere in between those two.
Right, because it's to the individual. And you can't tell an individual who has no knowledge of Shabbos, for example, that, okay, you can't turn on and off lights, you can't brush your teeth, you can't do, right? You can't do that. Just simply won't work. There has to be some other way.
I agree. But, that has a prior presumption that psak halakha has to work. And working implies a prior conception of what the purpose of halakha is. And that's, right, and that's a big, just realize, right, that's a, I tell one of my favorite stories, the second to last time I was called a kofer at YU, which I really enjoyed, was I gave a whole essay about Eid Echad Ne'eman B'Isurim, about why one witness counting for ritual purposes. And I was dealing with a position quoted by Rashi, which seems to suggest that the reason this is true is because otherwise husbands wouldn't be allowed to eat their wives' cooking, because there would be no evidence that it was actually kosher. So I was talking about this, and I suggested that this is an example of a sociological purpose. Right? Halakha is this way because otherwise society wouldn't develop the way we wanted to. So a student wrote me a long 3-page email explaining why this is heresy, with a very interesting argument. He said, it's clear that halakha in lots of areas doesn't work. Therefore, to claim it's supposed to work is heresy, because that would imply halakha is not running properly. So, just when it's not obvious to everybody that the notion that halakha is supposed to work is a true idea, I agree with you. But it's not. But you can take the Rav's philosophy, which is what that student was doing, and run with it to real extremes and claim that that question, it won't work for everyone, is the wrong question. Yes, Yisrael.
So I just want to give a concrete example, because we're talking in generalities, that we ran across here in shul last year, the year before. We have an issue, probably a lot of shuls do, that during slichos, in order to properly say slichos, you have to start really, really early, and it's hard to get them in, and it's an issue every year. So we know that in some places, you could say slichos the night before, or at midnight, or whatever, but exactly how late do you have to wait the night before you can do it, and can you do it after Maariv, whatever? And so people want to know, well, what did the Rav hold on this? So we asked people, being in Boston, people knew what his psak was, and it turned out he was really very surprisingly makel about when you could do it. And then we asked some people that knew what he said in New York, and he was very surprisingly machmir, that you had to do it, couldn't do it in the morning, it had to be at night, and it had to be after this, after that time. So the Rav was a big machmir on the time of slichos, and he was the opposite also, because he paskin in Boston completely differently than how he paskin in New York. So just a concrete example.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think there's a rich doctorate to be written on the difference between the Rav in Boston and the Rav in New York. If someone can get people to talk.
That's right. But if you wrote down, you wanted to write down, well, I asked people, and here's what the Rav held on this and that. Whatever you wrote about the Rav's opinion on slichos would be wrong, no matter what you wrote.
That's correct. I think that's right. Rabbi Strauss, do you have a question? No. Okay. So now let's talk about how this might relate, and we're obviously not going to have a chance to do it in great detail, how this might relate to what we're trying to accomplish in the Sermon of Midrash this summer. So what I'm thinking about, and what I hope that all of us are thinking about right now, is what the space is for religious experience of people with mental disabilities, either intellectual limits or forms of mental illness that cause you either to have loss of emotional control, loss of reliable perceptions of what the rest of us call reality, and issues like that. And the tension here is that there is a category called shota in halacha. And the category called shota in halacha seems to result in somebody being fundamentally outside the framework of halacha. Because halacha is a normative framework. It tells you the things that you have to do and the things you are not allowed to do. And so what framework is there for religious experience of somebody who neither has things they have to do nor things they are not allowed to do? What kind of space is there for religious experience? Yes?
So an onen,
I think that's an interesting framework, and it's a very powerful framework, and it's one in which, that's one of the areas where the Rav is really tremendously powerful. It's about what does it mean to be in that experience. But I think we could reframe that as they are in the grip of one overpowering religious obligation, which is burial. Right? The reason that they're exempt from all their mitzvot is because they have an obligation to bury. So they're not really removed from the framework. They're in a fascinating situation where one aspect of the normative framework overwhelms all the rest. Although it's a very, and I think, talk about the experience of not making brachot in that, it's often a really powerful religious experience for people who normally live within the framework of halacha, and it's a great analogy to talk about, you know, is there a space, and should there be a space for any religious experience during that time, or are you really just supposed to be so focused on the halakhic obligation of burial that there's no time for the distraction?
But I was thinking of it in a parallel that somebody who is perhaps in a state of what we might define as a form of mental illness, that they can be so focused on a delusional worldview or a view that's not within reasonably normal parameters, or that can be so overwhelming that there's a parallel.
Okay, so that's an interesting...
So they're in another reality, that their television is talking to them, this kind of thing, so the whole reality shifts.
So I think that's right, but on the other hand, you know, maybe there's no religious meaning to that reality, as opposed to the reality of an Onan, where there is power. But I think it's it's part of that question is it legitimate to have religious experiences while you're an Onan? Right, that's all, right? Maybe not in the same way. I know when I was many years ago, I think the first time I taught adults, I was teaching a course at Lincoln Square Synagogue called Advanced Talmud for Beginners, which is a really highly intellectual course. I love I still love quoting, like, one of my favorite reviews was there was a federal judge was taking the class, and I think he wrote, not recommended for those of ordinary intelligence. And my favorite was, like, you know, the really good, but it really worked well is you could see the smoke rising from inside people's heads. there was one fellow there who came, and he came every week. It didn't seem to me like he was getting much out of it intellectually, but he came to me and he said, you know, when you stand up there and talk, Rabbi Clapper, I just feel I have this overwhelming experience of God. And that was, you know, but he would ask irrelevant questions. He wasn't understanding anything I was doing, he would talk, you know. And so I was very tempted to put up a sign on the outside saying, Talmud Torah taking place, no religious experiences allowed. Right, that would be a sharp way of framing it. Or, you know, something like, if you must talk to God, please go to the corridor the way we say Hashkama. The other way around. at Israel of Sharon. So you might argue that, right, that, you know, that there's just no space. But then again, so the question is one way to deal with it is to simply say that, you know, what it's a wholly different kind of religious experience that has no relationship to what we talk about in halacha. But there are two other ways of doing it. One strategy would be to find ways within the formal framework of halacha that gives meaning to the experience of people even though they're in the category of shota. Right, within the framework of halacha, is there such a space where they have, right, where their experiences have meaning? So here, if you turn a couple of pages, I think the PDF didn't quite preserve the page breaks. So if you turn to what is the third page of the packet, I guess, so you'll see there's a piece from the Chidushim of the Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, in which he tries to address the following interesting phenomenon. What he says is that the Rambam quotes the following halakha. You have somebody who is directly, right, they're still underage when Pesach happens. Then they turn bar bat mitzvah, let's say bar mitzvah, before Pesach Sheni, the makeup korban. So there's you probably heard bar mitzvah drashas about this. Do they have to bring a korban Pesach on Pesach Sheni? Because here they are, because in this cycle, now they are obligated and they didn't fulfill it. So the Rambam says that if they were counted as part of an adult's korban during the first Pesach, they don't have to bring a korban on Pesach Sheni. But if they weren't counted, then they do have to. And that's really problematic because it seems to suggest that there's something that happened while they were children and not yet obligated that can fulfill an obligation when they're adults. And how can that be? And in case you just think theoretically it could happen, So the Rambam says he has. So the Reb Chaim says there's a case which explicitly says the reverse, which is the case that the Gemara cites, which is if you are forced by a demon to eat matzah on the first night of Pesach, and then you succeed in expelling the demon. So the question is, do you have to eat matzah again or not? And the answer is, you do. Because at the time that you ate the matzah, you were not obligated. And how can something done during a time when you're not obligated cause you to fulfill an obligation when you are? So now, Adam's about to say, I'm going to forestall you, that this is not quite the same thing, because we all know that children are not the same thing as people are insane. Children, there's an obligation of chinuch. Children are going to come to commandments. What were you going to say then?
Brit Milah.
Brit Milah is not the child's obligation.
It becomes the child's obligation if he doesn't have a Brit Milah when he's
13. That's true, but I think the way we frame that...
When he turns
13. Yeah, I think the way we frame that is it's the adult's obligation which the child then assumes when they reach majority. It's not the child's obligation.
Don't we do that with Gerim, though? If you're converted as a kid, then you have to accept the mitzvah once you become bar mitzvah?
Yeah, it doesn't work as a child.
Yeah, you have to do it.
That's right. So it's really mysterious what's going on with the sacrifice that lets you do it. Really, it shouldn't work. Yes, Yudah? Couldn't be included.
Of course he couldn't be included.
So you can't say it.
He can't be included the same way. It's still the same question as the katan.
But the katan can't be included. So we have to figure out how, right?
What does it mean?
Does he have to eat or is he held in mind?
For educational purposes. In what way is that really?
No, not for educational purposes. That's not the trick. It's not, the katan is not, it doesn't work because the katan is included for educational purposes.
I'm saying that's why we would assume it is included for not for the fact that it works.
So Reb Chaim denies all that. Okay, Reb Chaim's, right, the opportunity here is, right, to say, there's a difference between a child who exists within the framework of commandedness and a shota who doesn't exist within that framework at all. That's the opportunity to distinguish the cases. And if you look at Reb Chaim's piece, he doesn't even entertain the possibility. Right, he says there is. He does not attempt to explain this on the ground of distinguishing between the relationship of the child to mitzvot and the relationship of the shota to mitzvot. He comes up with a purely technical explanation. And its purely technical explanation is that in the realm of Korban Pesach, children are allowed to have children in mind while you sacrifice the Korban Pesach, which is what enables them to eat the Korban Pesach. And he says, in a case where the children can be related in some non-commanded way to the action of the mitzvah, and then the fulfillment of the mitzvah happens as a result of that action. So you don't have to have a direct connection between the child and the fulfillment. The child relates to the action and the fulfillment happens automatically. Then he says you can have a circumstance in which, even though the child is not commanded, they fulfill the mitzvah. Now, this is a really interesting claim. What I tried to get out of it is a much broader conceptual claim that there can be halakhically meaningful frameworks for people who are not in the framework of obligation, because the logic that Reb Chaim sets out would apply, right, is based on the assumption that there is no difference between a child and a shota. And he doesn't think it's incoherent to make the claim that somebody is outside the framework of obligation and nonetheless is capable of fulfilling a mitzvah. Now, in the end, he takes it back here, because he says it's a special law because children have a line about the Korban Pesach. But that's an example of what I would call a purely formal commitment within the realm of halachic man, where the only issue that matters is, was there some kind of halachic fulfillment or not? And Rav Soloveitchik seems to suggest that it's not a contradictory statement to say that so-and-so has no possibility of obligation, and yet they fulfilled the mitzvah. Right? That's not an incoherent statement for him. And that's one kind of, right? That's what I would say, the purely formal framework, although I admit that the reason one is looking for frameworks like this is that one has some kind of prior moral commitment to inclusion. Right? So it's using the formalistic framework without accepting the notion that there's no possibility of looking for some way that halakha works in terms of inclusion. Yes?
Usually, when somebody you
somebody
uh-huh.
in the mitzvah,
mm-hmm.
That somebody who is not doing the mitzvah has to accept it also,
mm-hmm.
right? But in this situation, the child doesn't accept it.
Absolutely right.
So how does it work?
So I think a really interesting question, right, is how hard it, what you're showing is how hard it is to think about halakha without using some kind of prior conception of justice or working or a thing like, because how does it work, right? How can you have a kiyum of a mitzvah
just
if you didn't do anything? Yes.
So they, like, even I have that in mind, they don't.
So that's a fair question. Let's talk about Erev Tavshilin, right? Also, right, we say it for the whole Jewish mm-hmm. people. And so usually, you know, the formal trick to accomplish that is to claim that everybody's default setting is to have in mind, right, is to endorse everything everyone else does for them halakhically, unless they specifically reject it. But again, that's, you know, that works formally, but then immediately the temptation is, but just because it works formally, you want to think, does it work? Right? It's very hard to think about halakha in those terms. So part of the interest to me of this approach, right, is here is say something that as soon as you start thinking about it, in any terms other than the formal structure of halakha, it stops making sense. But in the world of halakhic man, that's enough. As long as it makes sense internally.
So if I'm making Kabbalah,
yeah.
And my mother and my father are not, can I have that in mind?
No. That doesn't work. At all, right? It's only this case where he says it. That right? Why it's not right? That's why in the end he limits it. But the reason it doesn't work in this framework is because the halakha specifically says it doesn't work, and not because it couldn't possibly work because it makes no sense. Right? If halakha turned out saying that, in fact, let's say that we have the equivalent of the Mormons, right, signing people up after death, and thereby redeeming their souls. Well, as long as halakha said it, you know, we would have to say, what does that teach me about the way the universe functions? As opposed to, no, that doesn't make sense because it doesn't meet my prior conceptions of the way religion ought to work. Okay, yes, Anna.
Here, I was talking about a way in which a child, being someone who does not have an obligation, is either doing something or something done for them such that their later obligation, such that a mitzvah is fulfilled for them, and then later when they have obligation, that mitzvah was
you're right,
fulfilled.
Not,
but yeah. In this case, it's someone who, like, it doesn't seem... If the child, let's say, died before becoming bar mitzvah, you'd have to... Depending on how you think mitzvah work without outside of...
So
what
in this,
does that mean? Meaning, what happens if a person never becomes obligated?
It's a great question. In this formulation, I don't believe Rav Chaim says that. In this formulation... So one formulation is that when the child becomes bar mitzvah, then the obligation is fulfilled. I don't believe he says that. He says that the reason you don't have to bring a second korban is that you have already fulfilled the mitzvah in the past.
But what mitzvah?
The mitzvah.
The child doesn't have to.
See, right? Because you think it's incoherent, right? But he doesn't say that. He said the child had the kiyum mitzvah then, because you can have a kiyum mitzvah.
But you can only have the kiyum mitzvah if you're going to eventually have the chiyuv later, but you never have a chiyuv.
Then there would be a difference between a katan and a shota, and Rav Chaim could have gotten out of the whole problem.
Or a katan who dies.
Lots of ways out of it. Rav Chaim doesn't take them. That's what the whole power of this is. That he doesn't take any of those. Yes.
So, to clarify, it looks like what he did do, instead of saying Katan is different from Shota, Katan is different from Ger, is to say the mitzvah of Korban Pesach is a family mitzvah on some level, and therefore if this child had a family that took the sheep for the household, this mitzvah is operating special.
That
so
is...
not this Katan is operating special, it's this mitzvah is operating special.
So that's, I think, a... useful rationalization. I don't want to commit Rabbi Soloveitchik to that at this point in his argument. But that's a useful formulation because you could talk about other kinds of communal mitzvot, and can we give religious meaning to people who are legally incompetent participating in communal activities thereby, right? That would be right. That's why I think it's a useful formulation. But I don't want to commit him to it. Yes, Yuda.
What do you think his real answer is? I would guess that he would try to put any meaning to
category of matzah. Like, let me give you a good example. Let's say it's Erev Shabbos, and you turn, and your magdil, you have on Shabbos, and you make it early Shabbos, you make Kiddush, for example. So the captain has to make Kiddush again after, say.
Yeah, so in the end he's going to tell you that this only works by Korban Pesach because there's a special verse by Korban Pesach, which exists. Yeah, if he thought the verse played the same role, great.
So you think he would...
If he would be convinced that the purpose of that verse was to change the status of the Katan such that they could participate in the action of the mitzvah even though they have no obligation and the fulfillment of it happens automatically as a result of their participation in the action, he would say the same thing.
I see. But you don't think he would say that. My point is that I think if you give him any new mitzvah, you're asking to categorize it, he's going to put it in the category of matzah, if he at all can.
I know very little about Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. All I know are his essays, which don't tell you anything about how he handles practical questions.
Very weird ideas, like we always try to limit them, which I think is what he's trying to do with the whole verse thing. I guess one of the main points.
I'm not going to commit myself to what Reb Chaim would have done. Uh-huh. Yes.
Your original question: this is a mental illness, and how our perception will be similar to how we treat mitzvah when you're inebriated or under some type of drug?
So that's a fair question, whether inebriated kind of drug is just taken as an example of people who have episodic episodes of insanity, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Or like a demon.
Or demons, right? So demons are exactly that. Yeah. We'll have time for two quick approaches which are not totally formalistic, but try and give meaning to religious experience for people who are not entirely, right, people who are not capable of commandment. There are a bunch that we've tried. So one possibility, which if you look at the fifth page of the packet, I guess, is a fascinating notion of the Radbaz. So the Radbaz says that Ashota is invalid for testimony, because he's exempt, because he's not a ben mitzvot. Now, ben mitzvah is a term that can mean a lot of different things. The Radbaz translated as he's patur from mitzvot, he's exempt from mitzvot. And therefore, he says, he's exempt from mitzvot, even though he fulfills mitzvot at some point. His fulfillment of mitzvot is analogous to the way in which women fulfilling time-bound commandments. That even though he acknowledges and then says in the next line that there's a difference between saying that you're obligated in some commandments but not obligated in others, and you might say that therefore people are incapable of being commanded, their actions have no meaning, as opposed to people who are capable of commanded if they perform voluntary actions, right, those still have meaning. The Radbaz doesn't formulate it that way. He says that the actions of somebody who is completely exempt from commandments are also the actions of somebody who is not commanded but does. So that's a framework which says that you can have meaning to experience, that there's meaning to experience even if you don't fit in the normative framework at all. Okay, that's a second. Third argument, I think we'll finish with that. If you turn the page again. So at the end of that, Talmudic passage about the being possessed by demons to eat matzah, the Gemara says, Rava, that passage comes up in the context of the actual statement originally made is, people who eat matzah under compulsion do fulfill their obligation. So the Gemara says, compelled by whom? Compelled by demons, that doesn't work. Because when you're acting under the compulsion of a demon, you're insane and you can't fulfill an obligation. Because when you're sane, you're sane, and when you're not sane, you're not sane. So even if you're episodically possessed by demons, while you're possessed by the demon, you have no obligation. So the Gemara Rava then said. So the Gemara then concludes that in this weird phenomenon, which I don't understand the history of, that apparently there were bands of marauding Persians who would wander around on the first night of Pesach and compel Jews who were otherwise resistant to eat matzah on the first night of Pesach, and that works, right? That works as they don't tell Chabad. Right. You can wander around. We can have this is a fine example of effective kviyat datit, right, compelling, right, shoving matzah down people's throat on the first night of Pesach. Whatever it was. Okay, so now Rava says, this teaches us, in our version of the Talmud, this teaches us that if you blow shofar purely for musical purposes, that you also fulfill your obligation, because obviously an act taken under compulsion is not done with religious intent. So then an act done with totally neutral intent should be fine also. All that matters is the action of the mitzvah, not the intent. That's Rava's conclusion. We're not going to debate that right now. What interests us is that Rashi cites an alternative text. An alternative text says not that if you blow shofar lashir, for musical purposes, but rather hatokea lashed, if you blow shofar for the sake of a demon, that you are obligated. And that's weird, because we just said in the Talmud that if you eat matzah at the direction of a shade, you're not yotzei, so what should the difference be between matzah and shofar? So Rashi tells you that the difference is that you're not blowing the shofar at the behest of the shade, you're blowing the shofar in the attempt to get rid of the shade. But now we have to be careful. So Rabbi Tzal Zev Spern brings this up in the context of a question. We said that if you're sometimes lucid and sometimes not, while you're lucid, you're considered as a perfectly sane person, and while you're not, you're treated as a completely insane person. But there's a boundary between those, which is when you're on the road to recovery. When you're on the road to recovery, at what point do we see you as having traversed the boundary between insane and sane?
Responsible for your
act. Yes, right. At what point do you become chayav and mitzvot again? So one, pardon?
It's actually the other way as well.
Yes, it's true.
Right, because at what point do you become patur?
Right, so that I understand. There's going to be a line. When you become patur, there's going to be a line. The question is, when do you become chayav again? So one possibility is when you cross back from that line. The other possibility is you have to be fully recovered. Right, that the state continues until you get back to your baseline. We don't make you obligated again immediately the moment that you cross that you're at the bare boundary of responsibility. So Rabbi Spern raises that question. He says, at what point do you become responsible for your actions again? And he says, well, look at this Rashi. This Rashi tells me that somebody who blows a shofar in order to expel a demon, so that person fulfills their obligation. Now, they're not a healthy person. At the time they blow the shofar, they're still possessed by a demon, because you can't blow a shofar to expel a demon unless you're already possessed.
Somewhat a different person's demon.
No, you're that nice. There's no other person. There's no other person. Good try. I think Deborah might also have tried that one, but I don't think so. Somebody, my wife, somebody read this. I really don't think so. There's no grammatically. There's no third person. I'm not reading the text, so it's not fair to you. So it's, Rashi says, "May Allah from upon him." So that seems to suggest that somebody who is still possessed by a demon is capable of fulfilling mitzvot. Why? Because at the moment that they blow the shofar, they're not doing it because of the demon, they're doing it despite the demon. So I wanted to argue that what Rabbi Stern is really saying is there are people whom legally we could never hold responsible for their actions. Because anybody who's possessed by a demon is not always going to win, and we're not going to punish them for failing, because demons are very powerful. And the same token, somebody who is in the throes of depression or schizophrenia, the notion of holding them responsible for their actions doesn't seem viable. But if there is a moment where they can be sure themselves that they are doing this despite their mental illness and not as a reflection of it, if you're blowing the shofar not because of the voices in your head, but despite the voices in your head, so Rabbi Spern tells you that even though we couldn't hold you legally responsible, at the moment that you accomplish that, you still fulfill your obligation. So there's a possibility of fulfillment without the possibility of consequences. That's a second model for suggesting that there is capacity for religious experience in the third model, right? Yeah, right. Even at a time when halachically one is removed, right? One is removed from the normative framework. I think we'll end here. I think there are a whole bunch of other models like that. I hope you got a sense, both philosophically and practically, of what we're trying to accomplish. Yes, Israel, take questions.
It's a little bit narrower case. Like it's not.
Yes.
It's not that the person was insane and then tried to help someone out or do some different mitzvah.
Yeah.
They were insane and they tried to get rid of the insanity.
Yes, so you could limit it by saying it's only dafka because they're trying to get rid of it, as opposed to the other way of reading it is that it's a paradigmatic action that is taken, right, that is taken despite rather than before. You could argue that, you know, what I'm suggesting, I guess, is, let's take the third case. Let's suppose that this person who is possessed by a demon comes to you and says, I would like to blow shofar for the shul this year. So we look at you, right, and look, see, I can blow shofar. And I would say to you, no, right, because I don't know that you're blowing shofar or the demon. You'll say, why don't we ask him? Well, the answer is, well, the demon would certainly say that, right? So I think the answer is that this is a person who, in a sense, has to, right, their only relationship to halakha has to be subjective. We can't possibly tell you whether you fulfilled your obligation or not, because we can't know what's going on in your head. Only you can. And I think that's the kind of where that's how it intersects with the philosophic framework, that there's a halakha that exists only in certain people's heads. But I understand you could read it more narrowly, and right, that's part of the broader philosophic question. Yes, Chuck and then Avi, yes.
So I have a question about this statement here. So we know that we're not obligated to, the obligation is not really to blow, it's to hear.
Me passing that way, yes.
Okay, so when they say in the Gemara, when they say blow, do they really mean hear?
So that's a dispute between northern and southern France. And in northern France, at least early on, they held that the mitzvah was really to blow. In southern France, they held that the mitzvah was to listen. It's interesting. It's an article I wrote, so I don't think I know these kind of things off the cuff. That you can watch, actually, the northern French halachic writings have the bracha as litkoa, and then in the manuscripts they get overwritten in lishmoa. But I don't think that you can decide one or the other. I think both traditions knew how to interpret all these texts, but it wouldn't matter in this case because the person is blowing to fulfill so that they can listen to it, and you have to, and even the people who say the mitzvah is to hear believe that you have to hear it from somebody who is blowing with intent.
I have a particular reason for some. I do fulfill that obligation for people here at KTM, and I'm often asked the question, not every year, but often asked the question, what's the hardest part? And for me, always the hardest part is making sure I'm hearing what I'm doing and not just concentrating on what I'm doing.
Interesting.
Right? Because I could simply make the notes and just concentrate on making the notes and not concentrate on the hearing, but I don't know how to, right? I think that's the important part is the hearing part.
That's interesting. So you're right, the way we paskin.
Right. Correct, but that's the only way that I knew until this very end, right? Now that I hear not to do something else, I don't have to listen.
No.
So it would be easier.
No, we pass in, you know, we pass in the midst of his hearing and not blow. I never thought of that interesting question, whether you can be so focused on blowing that you don't actually... I guess the question if you...
It's not focused on blowing, it's focused on making it right.
Yes. Or you could wear earmuffs, I guess.
Well, no, but just because you're hearing doesn't mean you're really hearing.
Right?
Right. I mean, you
we need an equivalent of you see Watson, but you don't observe.
Right.
That's a great question. Yeah, I think a little bit beyond the scope where we are today, but it's a great question. Avi, question?
I'm not sure I understand why it is that if this person who's possessed by a demon or whatever it is does an action. Right. Why should he not be held responsible if that action was done in the attempt to dispel the demon? Or not in the attempt to dispel the demon, but resisting it?
So I think we have no external access to his mind. And also, I think that there is a stage, which I tried to argue this last Friday in Shir, there's a stage in which people have free will, but not enough free will to be held legally accountable. And interesting analogy is right, people is addiction. Right, what happens if you hold that, you know, that it's it's completely forbidden to take a certain drug. But people are addicted to it. So you might say that you can't hold them legally accountable for what they do when they're on a binge. And at the same time, you can give them credit. If even for the, you know, for that 10 seconds, the 10 seconds they resist the drink, you can give them credit for that, even though when they give in, you're not going to hold them legally accountable. Now that rests on your whole question of whether you accept the notion of addiction, and right, an addiction is a disease as opposed to a moral, right? Those are profound questions which are beyond our scope here. But that's what I'm suggesting, is that there are frameworks where the legal system, right, you're not in the normative framework of the legal system, and that doesn't mean their actions are meaningless, right? Because you say, well, halakha says you're incompetent, you know, it doesn't count, so what does it matter? You might as well just go whole hog. You know, so once you're on a binge, right, drink everything because you're wholly unaccountable. Sounds interesting. Not so, right? That the legal framework is not the only normative framework that that binds you. Okay, thank you very much as always. Ever a pleasure to be here.